The House impeachment inquiry continues amid reports that there's more than one whistleblower. Plus, the United Auto Workers Union rejects General Motors' latest offer to end a strike. And bad cell service in the subway? We'll delve into what's behind connection problems.
It really is sort of a puzzle that takes the municipalities and the carriers and, in some cases, the contractor to make it work.
It's Monday, October 7th. This is the AM edition of What's News from the Wall Street Journal. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli in New York. A nationwide strike of General Motors employees is now in its fourth week after the United Auto Workers Union rejected the latest offer from GM to end the standoff. The top bargainer for the union said on Sunday that the talks had taken a turn for the worse and that GM's latest proposal was similar to a previously rejected proposal with little changes. The strike is already GM's longest since 1970, when workers picketed for 67 days. Analysts estimate GE is losing $50 million to $100 million a day in lost factory production. The strike has halted output at more than 30 GM plants in the U.S. Negotiations are expected to resume on Monday. The U.S. Supreme Court begins its new term today, and the court has some big cases on the docket, focusing on issues including abortion, gun rights, and immigration. On Tuesday, the court will hear arguments in a case focusing on whether federal civil rights law protects LGBTQ people from discrimination in the workplace. The president's efforts to cancel the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, will be in focus next month. The Supreme Court has also agreed to rule on abortion restrictions in the state of Louisiana. And the court will take up gun rights in December in its first major Second Amendment case in a decade. The U.S. and China are gearing up for the latest round of trade talks in Washington this week. And our Josh Zumrun says there's a new wild card in the mix.
I think one thing that really complicates all of this is the kind of impeachment drama in Washington. There's a big question, I think, over whether or not this weakens the president in the eyes of the Chinese, who view him as politically vulnerable, or if this maybe makes the president, you know, more inclined to be tough on China to kind of show some of the things the administration is doing. I guess what we'd say is that impeachment is a big wild card. You know, this is already extremely unpredictable. These trade negotiations have been unpredictable from the very beginning. People who've tried to guess which way it's going have almost always gotten it wrong. And I think this adds just another degree of unpredictability to it.
Still, there are some signs of progress.
I think you can say that there's two positive signs that we're seeing. One is that the high-level negotiators are back at the table. I mean, this is the first time since July that we've had high-level negotiations. This is going to be the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, the Treasury Secretary, and then China's top trade negotiators as well. And this is a group that hasn't talked in, like I said, almost 3 months. So that's a positive sign. And the second positive sign is that China has started to buy more agricultural products in a meaningful way. And we're starting to see some positive signs out of China. They're really buying soybeans. They're buying pork again. The U.S. farm economy is really far away from kind of recovered or back to health. But this is kind of a step in the right direction.
That's The Wall Street Journal's Josh Zumbrun. Negotiators from the U.S. and China are set to meet in Washington on Thursday and Friday. There's a slump in the IPO market. Investors were optimistic at the start of the year, beginning with Pinterest, Zoom, Uber, and Lyft all making their public debuts. The ride-hailing companies have since seen declines. Lyft's stock has fallen 46%, and Uber's stock has declined 34%. Last week also brought bad news from a highly anticipated company planning to debut. Shared office space company WeWork pulled the plug after the company came under scrutiny and its CEO stepped down. According to a research note from Goldman Sachs, IPO stock performance is at its worst since at least 1995. Over the weekend, attorneys for the CIA officer behind the whistleblower complaint that launched an impeachment inquiry into the president revealed the existence of more than one whistleblower. The revelation comes as the House impeachment inquiry enters its third week. The Wall Street Journal's Siobhan Hughes has more from Washington.
There are, in fact, multiple whistleblowers, according to the legal team that's representing the CIA officer who filed the original whistleblower complaint. Now, what we know is that at least one of the whistleblowers who has come forward is also an intelligence official, and this person has come forward and said that he or she has firsthand knowledge of some of the allegations described in that initial complaint. That's important because a lot of Republicans have been attacking the initial whistleblower for providing information that was secondhand, that was based on facts that he or she had not been able to ascertain on a first-person basis. We do know that that additional whistleblower has not actually filed a separate formal whistleblower complaint. So it's possible that this second whistleblower is just somebody who has been interviewed by the Inspector General for the intelligence community for corroborating information. But it is significant that there are multiple people who could potentially stand up and validate what that first whistleblower had claimed.
The initial whistleblower complaint alleges that the president sought to use the powers of his office to push Ukraine to investigate Democratic rival Joe Biden. This week, House lawmakers will hear from additional key witnesses on Capitol Hill.
There is always the possibility that the whistleblower who sparked the impeachment inquiry could testify behind closed doors to the House Intelligence Committee. But what is primary is that the three committees at the center of the impeachment inquiry are set to speak behind closed doors with two more State Department officials. They are Marie Yovanovitch, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, and Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union. Both are still State Department officials. Marie Yovanovitch, though, working back in the United States after being recalled from the Ukraine earlier this year when President Trump ordered her removal after his allies outside the administration, including Rudy Giuliani, had claimed she was undermining him and blocking efforts to persuade Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden. That according to a Wall Street Journal report from last week, citing people familiar with the matter. Gordon Sondland, in the meantime, a primary focus because he appears to have suggested that there was a link between the president's interest in a Biden investigation, in Ukraine investigating the origins of Robert Mueller's Russia inquiry, and President Trump's decision to put on hold nearly $400 million in military aid to Ukraine.
That's The Wall Street Journal's Siobhan Hughes. As the impeachment inquiry into the president continues, our Jason Bellini took a look at the history of impeachment in the United States and the origins of the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors.
We do go back to the 19th century because 150 years ago, that's when we had our very first impeachment experience as a country. And at that time, members of Congress were trying to figure out what did the founders mean when they said high crimes and misdemeanors. And I spoke with Frank Bowman. He's a law professor who wrote a book called High Crimes and Misdemeanors. And what he says is that it doesn't mean what we really think it means. We hear the word crimes. We think there must be crimes involved. Well, no, they took this language, the architects of the Constitution took this language from British parliamentary procedure. And what they really mean is that it's just something of great gravity.
Experts he spoke with said the bar for impeachment is high.
Professor Frank Bowman, who wrote the book on high crimes and misdemeanors that came out recently, he said that it's a remedy that should be used only when the president presents a danger to the country itself. And I think we're going to hear a debate about high crimes and misdemeanors and whether we can wait, whether the country can wait for the voters to decide, whether we should wait for the voters to decide about a year from now.
For more, check out Jason Bellini's video on our website, wsj.com/video. Can't get cell service underground? That may be a pain during your commute, but there are plenty of challenges to providing cell service on the subways. Joining me now to talk about some of them is Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Krause. So, Sarah, this gets complicated, and the reasons why, like most things, have to do with money. You found that even if cities do commit to spending more, it can be difficult to incentivize wireless carriers that this is a worthwhile endeavor for them. Can you explain that?
Sure. So building out underground connectivity is not cheap. It's very difficult to do. It often involves rerouting trains and getting access to the tracks in the first place. But for the carriers, it's an additional investment when it doesn't necessarily equate to additional revenue coming in the door, especially now that we're very data-centric in terms of our usage. There was a time when we paid per minute. So to add connectivity underground might mean that you could recoup some of that. But now we're all on unlimited data plans. You're not really bringing in a new customer by adding this connectivity. You're just trying not to frustrate your existing base of customers. So for carriers, it's more about avoiding churn or avoiding commuters jumping to their rival. But if no one has connectivity underground, the competitive threat is much different than if you're, say, at a stadium and the guy next to you has service but you don't.
That doesn't even get into the challenges of working within existing infrastructure to wire up underground tunnels.
Yes, and actually in Chicago, where this was done in 2015, the contractors built a custom train. So it was like a 25-car train that had 50 to 75 different engineers and safety people on it that sort of moved like an assembly line. So they had to reroute trains out of the way, put the train on the track, and build it out. And Chicago is much smaller than New York or D.C., so these are really complicated projects in a market like D.C. You have competing access for the tunnels. There's, you know, different safety and law enforcement parties that need to have access, et cetera. So it really is sort of a puzzle that takes the municipalities and the carriers and in some cases the contractor to make it work. You know, like even in New York, where they've brought Transit Wireless, this company that contracts with MTA, has brought connectivity, wireless connectivity to the subway platforms. But those antennas are typically in the middle of the platform. So it's a nice to have, and the carriers do pay to bring their cellular coverage underground using the same equipment. But it doesn't extend into the tunnel. So you end up sort of having connectivity in the station. As soon as you leave and you're in the middle of the tunnel, you're dark. If you get stuck in a tunnel, you're dark for a long time. So there is incremental progress in the form of that. But I think it's still a frustrating commuter experience once you get, you know, sort of further away and further into the tunnels. The other thing that I would say from the transit agency perspective is this isn't their core business. Their core business is getting you safely from point A to point B. They have a lot of capital expenses. They don't have a lot of extra budget floating around, if any. So there's a lot of competing priorities for how to spend resources. So from their perspective, you know, safety, reliability, those are sort of top of the list. Wireless connectivity is seen as sort of a nice to have.
Who is doing this well right now and who is not doing this so well?
So I would say that the most advanced systems in this tend to be in Asia and Eastern Europe. So if you think about like the Moscow Metro, if you think about Seoul in South Korea, you know, if you think about Tokyo, these are wired systems where, you know, the government tends to spend more on public transit. There tends to be more, you know, sort of government pressure on carriers to do the build out and put the money forward to add to their systems. So those are parts of the world where a rider getting on a commuter train or subway is going to have full connectivity throughout their journey, less so in America.
For many of us, not having wireless underground can be a minor inconvenience, but you talk in your piece about how this can also perpetuate socioeconomic divides. Could you go into that a little bit?
Yeah. So I think, you know, for a lot of us, we think about, okay, I need to time my Twitter taps or I need to like load up that article that I want to look at, you know, so that I can get it to work. If you're on, you know, a 2-hour, an hour long commute, if you're coming up from the Bronx, if you're coming up from the far reaches of Brooklyn, for example, you're on the train for a really long time. And that's time that you could do homework. It's time that you could pay bills. It's time you could stay in touch with loved ones. It's sort of a lost opportunity if you're in the dark for a large proportion of that.
That's The Wall Street Journal's Sarah Krause joining me in our studio in New York. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
What about you? If you take the subway or other trains during your commute, what kind of wireless service do you get? Join the conversation on our website or let us know by tweeting us at WSJ Podcasts. And that's what's news for this Monday morning. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.